Today is Thursday, December 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Muslim world leaders condemn President Trump's decision to declare Jerusalem the capital of Israel.
They view Trump's action as indicating bias in favor of Israel and therefore forfeiting, at least temporarily, America's role as an honest broker.
Republicans look at what's next following a Democratic upset in Alabama. More proof that drinking coffee can be good for your health. Also ahead, Google's top search terms for 2017. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, 22 leaders in the Islamic world gathered in Istanbul Wednesday in response to President Donald Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. The meeting comes as unrest in the Middle East continues, along with growing concern over the Jerusalem move. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert responded Wednesday to that outcry.
We remain hard at work in putting together our plan. We believe that that will benefit both the Israeli and the Palestinian people. It is also important, I want to point out, to ignore some of the distortions and instead focus on what the president actually said last week. The specific boundaries of Israeli sovereignty in Jerusalem are subject to final status negotiations between the parties. The United States continues to take no position on any final status issues, and the United States would support a two-state solution. We've long talked about this, if both sides can agree on this.
The gathering in Istanbul was under the auspices of the 57-nation Organization of the Islamic Conference, or OIC. Turkey currently leads the OIC, and the emergency summit was called by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. As the group condemned Trump's announcement, they called on the world to recognize East Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Russell Stone, professor emeritus with the Center for Israel Studies at American University, if that's a realistic possibility.
It might be possible. It would have to be negotiated. The Palestinians have always asserted that they want an independent state with East Jerusalem as its capital. There's nothing new to this. In fact, there was under construction a possible parliament building in the village of Abu Dis, which is a part of East Jerusalem. It's just outside the separation wall that's been created by Israel. Construction on that building has stopped, and in the meantime, the Palestinians are operating with Ramallah as their capital.
This meeting in Istanbul was organized by Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. More than 50 Muslim countries were in attendance. Are they reaching out to the rest of the world, or is this primarily an Arab-Muslim movement?
It's a Muslim movement. They're not all Arab countries. The organization, which Erdogan is acting on behalf of, the Organization for Islamic Cooperation, is an organization of that is represented by the governments of countries that have either a majority or substantial Muslim populations. Not all of them are Arab.
So obviously each country in the world, some 190, 200 plus or so, would be asked to recognize East Jerusalem rather than this being a function of the UN.
If they move ahead with it, that's true. This organization, by the way, has observer status in the United Nations, so they could act within the context of the United Nations. They haven't chosen to do so far.
Mr. Erdogan also said that the U.S. had forfeited its role as broker of Middle East peace. What do you make of that assessment?
Well, this just follows a declaration by Mahmoud Abbas, the head of Palestine, who said the same thing. They view Trump's action as indicating bias in favor of Israel and therefore forfeiting, at least temporarily, America's role as an honest broker in negotiations.
He said we need to discuss who will be a mediator from now on. Who might that be?
He didn't name anybody, nor is there any indication that others have stepped up. Obviously, the Russian leader Vladimir Putin aspires to as much influence in the world as he can establish. It hasn't gone in that direction so far.
The U.S. State Department spokesperson on Wednesday responded to the meeting, calling the statement about East Jerusalem as inflammatory rhetoric, that the president is committed to the peace process. The type of rhetoric we heard has prevented peace in the past, she said, urging people to ignore some of the distortions and focus on what the president actually said. Do you consider this inflammatory rhetoric?
It has proven to be not helpful in that it was predictable that there would be a reaction to it. And I'm not sure that the American administration thoroughly thought through what that reaction might be. There have been deaths as a result of demonstrations. That there would be demonstrations was predictable. That there would be deaths as a result of President Trump's action is something that probably was not considered carefully enough.
Since the president made his declaration on December 6, you had 2 days later Palestinians calling for a day of rage in Jerusalem. Shortly after that, Turkey's president described Israel as a terrorist state and vowed we will not abandon Jerusalem to the mercy of a state that kills children. Of course, Mr. Netanyahu, the prime minister, responded forcefully to that statement. Are you surprised at the level of reaction that you've seen so far? Could it have been worse than it has been?
Yes, I think the level of reaction is not nearly what it could have been. The call, what happened could nowhere be considered an expression of days of rage. There were demonstrations in the Palestine territories, particularly in Gaza. There were demonstrations in a few other Arab countries, but they were not as massive or as long in duration as might have been expected.
Why?
I don't think there's that much commitment to the Palestinian cause in the Arab street, as it's called, among the broader populace in Arab or Muslim countries.
Does that undercut what occurred in Istanbul on Wednesday?
No, this was government leaders. This was government representatives. The distinction between what governments do and how much people want to get involved is a distinction that we need to keep in mind.
That's VOA's Victor Beatty talking to Russell Stone, Professor Emeritus with the Center for Israel Studies at American University. Democrat Doug Jones's victory in Alabama's special Senate election sent shockwaves Wednesday across Capitol Hill, emboldening Democrats while forcing Republicans to grapple with a soon-to-be slimmer Senate majority than will make enacting President Trump's agenda all the more difficult in 2018, an election year. Jones held a news conference Wednesday where reporters asked if he thought allegations of improprieties against his controversial opponent, Roy Moore, helped him win.
Well, I don't know if I would have or not. I think that, I said from the very beginning, I think Roy Moore was disqualified from this job to begin with because he had been removed from office twice for violating the rule of law. There were serious questions about his moral foundation of law, which seemed to be nothing more than a way to enrich himself and his family. I think the last month of the election would have played out somewhat differently, obviously, but I think we would have still won.
Meanwhile, Moore has so far refused to concede to a loss. This is what he told supporters after the race was called for Jones.
What we've got to do is wait on God and let this process play out. I know it's late. We can't wait and have everybody wait till after 11 o'clock. But the votes are still coming in, and we're looking at that.
Well, joining me now to talk about the stunning upset is correspondent Chip Brownlee with the Alabama Political Reporter. So you were there at the Jones campaign election night party. What were people thinking as they waited for the results?
I would say going into it, there was a understanding that it was going to be close. I don't think anybody was really sure that Doug Jones was going to pull it out. I think there were a lot of people that just based off of Alabama's history being such a red state were sure that Moore was going to pull it out. But I think any journalist on the ground here knew that it was going to be close. But I wouldn't go so far as to say anybody expected Doug Jones to win.
So what was it like being in that room when they made the call that he had won?
It was ecstatic. They had CNN on the big screens there. And as soon as Doug Jones pulled ahead, people were screaming. Some people were crying. They were clapping. And I think once they saw that shift mm-hmm. and people knew that there were a lot of big urban areas that had yet to come in that they knew that were going to go for Jones, people started feeling a lot more confident. Earlier in the night when Moore was leading, it was a little bit more subdued. And I think people, you know, they weren't, I don't know how many people expected to actually win, but when they saw it shift and they knew that those big counties still had to come in, they got really excited.
How stunning was it for Alabama after 25 years to actually elect a Democrat to the Senate?
That's a good question. You know, I was sitting there and I was looking around and there were probably 150 journalists there. And I covered Donald Trump visits here. I covered Hillary Clinton visits here. That was a press pool in there that was bigger than any presidential visit that we've had. I've never seen that many journalists here. So there was obviously a lot of national and international attention. And when it tipped like that, that was like an earth-shattering occurrence. A Democrat has not been elected in Alabama since 1992 when then Senator Richard Shelby was running for re-election, and 2 years later he became a Republican. So it's been a quarter century since the state has elected a Democrat. This has been a red state for a long time.
What do you think tipped the scales for him? Was it, what did it for people to get out, many that maybe wouldn't have voted, or people that didn't like the other candidate? What do you think inspired people to do what they did to make this happen?
I think this was a perfect storm of opportunity for Doug Jones. You know, for the last 2 weeks, this has been a tale of two campaigns. And on one side, you had Doug Jones, who was making four or five trips a day to campaign events, campaign rallies. He was visiting churches. He was knocking on doors. He had hundreds of volunteers who knocked on, he says, hundreds of thousands of doors, and they made more than 1 million phone calls, apparently. So on one side, you had Doug Jones' campaign with this really, really strong get-out-the-vote operation. And then on the other side, you had Roy Moore, who spent the last week off the campaign trail. The week before, he had one rally on Monday night with Steve Bannon. And then for the next week, he basically disappeared from the campaign trail. In the final week leading up to the election, he was gone. And then he had one election eve rally with Steve Bannon again. So Roy Moore was gone. He didn't take questions from the media. He wasn't speaking with voters. And I think Alabamians, I think that played a role going into it, because I think Alabamians saw that and maybe saw that as a partial acknowledgement of wrongdoing with these sexual assault allegations. That might have played into it. They might have seen it as he thought he was due in for it, or that he was entitled to the seat. So, and then you also had the sexual assault allegations in themselves. You know, all of a vast, vast majority, almost all of Doug Jones' voters believed the sexual assault allegations. So I think that played a big role. And for college-educated Republicans, business-minded Republicans, crossover Republicans, and independents who really joined this kind of strange, unique coalition that Doug Jones built between those crossover Republicans, young voters who really turned out in the college counties and the college towns, and black voters who really turned out, and women, particularly black women, who showed up in the force for Doug Jones, and it pushed him over the top.
What are you hearing, or what do you make of the fact that Roy Moore will not concede at this point?
It's probably difficult for him right now and for his campaign right now to admit that they lost. I think that's why he spent the last week off the campaign trail, because he thought he had it won. This is a heavily conservative state, and he probably figured that he had done enough to win the election. And then when it went the other way, it was shocking to them. It was close. It was still close enough for him to cast some doubt on it, to be able to wait around until the election results are officially certified, which won't be done until later this month. And at that point, he can request a recount. I can't even think of any situation where there would be 20,000 votes come in for Roy Moore right now that would flip it for him. So I'm not sure what he's waiting on, but just based off what we've seen here on the ground, it's very unlikely that any votes are going to change and that the results are going to change. And there's probably not going to be a recount. And if there is a recount, he's going to have to pay for it.
All right. Well, we appreciate all of that and your perspective, Chip Brownlee, reporter with the Alabama Political Reporter. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Pro-Syrian government forces aim to seize the last opposition-controlled stronghold city. A key U.S. justice official expresses confidence in the Russia probe. Microsoft updates Bing search to highlight reputable results. And a British baby with a heart outside the body survives three surgeries. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. African and European leaders called for intensifying the fight against terrorism in the Sahel during a meeting Wednesday outside of Paris, as the recently created G5 Sahel force received fresh funding pledges. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has more from the French capital.
partenaire qui a également été acté aujourd'hui.
French President Emmanuel Macron announced Saudi Arabia was contributing $100 million and the United Arab Emirates another $30 million to the G5 Sahel force. The United States and European Union have already announced contributions of roughly $60 million each.
Ma préoccupation essentielle aujourd'hui, c'est qu'il nous faut...
Macron said France's 4,000-strong Barkhane operation in the Sahel will work with the G5 soldiers next year to combat jihadist groups in the region, such as Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. He predicted victories against the groups early in the year. Wednesday's meeting west of Paris aimed to inject fresh support for the G5, launched last July to tackle rising terrorism across the vast expanse of Africa's Sahel region. Five African nations are contributing to the force, which is expected to grow to 5,000 troops by next March. But experts say it needs more soldiers, training and funding, among other things, to tackle the spreading jihadi threat. Leaders also talked about other challenges.
En ce qui nous concerne le G5 Sahel, nous sommes conscients que le temps nous est compté.
Mali's president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta, warned Wednesday that with their routing in Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East, Islamic State group fighters could end up in the Sahel. Beyond French troops, other Western forces and UN peacekeepers are also present in the Sahel. A number have been killed in recent weeks. That includes four U.S. soldiers who were ambushed in October in a remote part of Niger, along with four Nigerian soldiers. UN and other African troops have also been targeted. This year also saw terrorist attacks in Mali and Burkina Faso. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, we have heard it before, but new research reconfirms that coffee is a healthy drink. But some of the other habits associated with the ritual of drinking coffee aren't so much. VOA's George Putik explains.
Perhaps the best demonstration of coffee's impact worldwide happened recently in Beijing, the capital of tea-drinking China, where the U.S.-based chain Starbucks opened its largest shop, taking up 2,700 square meters and employing more than 400 people. While the shop's popularity is not just for coffee's health benefits, a new study says they are indisputable.
There are some headline benefits, such as a lower risk of dying from any cause, a lower risk of dying from heart disease and stroke, and a lower risk of developing heart disease in the first place. And for those outcomes, the maximum benefit was around 3 to 4 cups of coffee per day.
Analyzing results of 201 previous studies about coffee's impact, researchers at the University of Southampton's Faculty of Medicine found that drinking coffee also lowers the risk of developing diabetes, liver disease, dementia, and even some cancers. The only exception was for pregnant women or those who are prone to bone fractures. But scientists point out the research was only about coffee, not what goes along with it.
It's not about the sugar and the syrups and the biscuits, cakes and pastries. And we'd urge people who are already drinking moderate amounts of coffee, about 3 or 4 cups per day mark, to enjoy it, but try and make it as healthy as possible, because standard health messages still apply to those other things.
The greatest benefit was in fighting liver diseases, so researchers are planning a clinical test of using coffee as a treatment for cirrhosis. But for some coffee lovers, there may be another circumstance that carries additional benefits: drinking coffee with pets around.
Pets are not only good for our health, but they can be good for our wealth, particularly if you have them in a small business environment where customers are going to be drawn in to interact with the dog or come in, and it's a really good icebreaker.
Private coffee shop owners take note. Having a pet in your cafe may benefit your business as well as your customers. George Putich, VOA News.
Well, turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchewski. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, Lori, when people are really happy or angry or passionate about a topic on Twitter, they sometimes have more to say than Twitter's new 280-character limit will even allow.
Really?
So they send out one tweet and another and another and another, and they basically break up a paragraph worth of thoughts into one line or less than one line at a time.
Right.
It's called a tweet storm, and it's something that countless Twitter users have done. It's something that President Trump has done quite a lot as he's used Twitter. Well, today Twitter is making the tweet storm process a whole lot easier.
Really?
Yes, because there's a new feature on the Twitter app on Apple and Android phones that'll allow you to type a series of tweets on one screen. So you can parse out your thoughts over multiple messages. You can see everything that you're trying to say in one place. And then when you're finished with that tweet storm, you hit tweet all, and all of those tweets in the series are sent out all at once. So you can, instead of trying to figure out what you said in the last tweet and did you repeat yourself or edit, it makes it a lot easier to do that. Now, the new feature isn't available yet. It's being rolled out in the next few weeks, but Twitter is making the announcement. But be warned, you're going to start to see more and more tweet storms and tweet threads as a result of this. So if you start to see more people having a lot more to say on Twitter, this could be the reason why.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Anything else going on?
Yeah,
although that's a lot.
That is a lot. But no, it's, you know, we're rapidly approaching the end of 2017, which means it's time for all of those end of year lists. And of course, last week we talked about two of them, Facebook's list of the top trends and stories in 2017, and then that YouTube video where they highlighted the year in memes, songs, videos, and everything else visual. Well, today we have another one of those lists, and this is a pretty good one, Lori. It's from Google. It's the list of top search terms 2017. And they break it down pretty extensively. Most searched, you know, actor and actress, most searched music, most searched sporting events. And my favorite is the most searched for recipe, which was, by the way, the recipe for cooking chicken breasts. So there you have it, of all things. But the leading the overall search is the number one overall top search term this year, Hurricane Irma. Of course, that storm that devastated wide swaths of the Caribbean and Puerto Rico. Number two and three, not surprising given that Apple is always a big topic of conversation. Number two and three were the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 10, respectively.
Gotcha.
Number four was Matt Lauer, the former host of the Today Show, who was fired over sexual assault allegations. And number five, a princess-to-be, Meghan Markle, who will be marrying Prince Harry in the spring of 2018. Other terms in the top 10 were Tom Petty, fidget spinners, of course, those are a fad among young people, and India's national cricket team. Always a lot of interest in cricket around the world, and particularly India doing pretty well. All of these stats that I've mentioned are for global searches, but you can also specify by country, which is pretty cool. So you can see how different countries compare. And to check it all out, you just go to google.com/2017, and you can select either global or your specific country. And have fun with it. It's a lot of fun categories, and it gives a good kind of time capsule over the past year to see what's gone on, what people have been interested in, and what has risen to the top of Google searches.
All right, Andrew, thank you. And you can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, lead singer and songwriter of the New Jersey rock band Smithereens, Pat DeNizio, has died at the age of 62. The band announced on Facebook that DeNizio died Tuesday, but they didn't provide the cause. D'Annunzio posted just several days ago that he was hopeful to get back to work on tour as he continued physical therapy for neck and back injuries at his Victorian farmhouse where he was restoring, which he was restoring in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. D'Annunzio and several of his Carteret High School classmates formed the Smithereens in 1980. The band's 1986 Blood and Roses was featured in the movie Dangerously Close. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. That does it for today's show. But thank you for listening, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Around the world, excess and loosely secured stockpiles of small arms, light weapons, and munitions, along with landmines and explosive remnants of war, pose a serious danger not only to local populations, but also to regional stability and prosperity. The dangers posed by mines and UXO can linger for decades, wrote Tina Kidenow, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military Affairs. In areas reeling from recent fighting, stabilization and humanitarian assistance efforts are effectively blocked until key sites are cleared of explosive hazards. Civilian populations near contaminated land could face permanent injury or death by performing everyday activities such as accessing clean water or walking to work or school. That is why the U.S. Department of State funds and manages conventional weapons destruction programs in 47 countries around the world. It's To Walk the Earth in Safety report, issued in mid-December by the State Department's Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement, highlights our enduring commitment to make post-conflict communities safer and setting the stage for their recovery and development. It also touches on many of the problems these communities must overcome. In Africa, decades of past conflicts have left behind dense minefields, while porous state borders and weak governments have allowed extremist groups such as Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab to easily arm themselves with weapons and explosives. In East Asia and the Pacific, due to a series of armed conflicts going back to the 1940s, landmines and unexploded ordnance have remained a persistent threat. Similarly, in the Balkans and in Ukraine, minefields and poorly secured stockpiles of weapons are also a cause for concern. In the Middle East and North Africa, efforts at regional stabilization and conflict resolution are hampered by unexploded ordnance and surplus weapons resulting from decades of instability and conflict. The same can be said for Afghanistan and some of its Central Asian neighbors. And in Latin America, conventional weapons destruction is crucial to stem regional threats of violence and weapons trafficking that go hand in hand with illegal narcotics trafficking and criminal violence. Supporting conventional weapons destruction is a cornerstone of our national security policy, said Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Kidenow. The success of our programs is built on strong bipartisan support from Congress and the people of the United States, who recognize that our nation benefits from helping to create a world in which all may walk the earth in safety.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.